Welcome to your Right to Speak discussions on child and youth rights and advocacy. This is episode one. I'm your host, Sammy D'Agostino. Today, it's a very exciting day. It's the first episode of your Right to Speak, and I'm very excited that our first guest is Erwin Ellman, the Provincial Advocate for Children and Youth in Ontario. Erwin, can you intro yourself?
Hi, Sammy. Thank you for having me. It's exciting to be the inaugural guest. I'm really pleased about that. Congratulations on this effort. I'm the Provincial Advocate for Children and Youth in Ontario. It means I'm an officer of the legislature. I have a piece of legislation that tells me what I can and cannot do and gives me direction. And in a nutshell, my job is to elevate the voice of the most vulnerable children and youth in the province, those on the margins of state care or in state care in some way, in youth justice system, children's mental health system, child welfare system, including children and youth with special needs, as my act says, or First Nations children and youth. And our organization and our legislation is rights-based. So it tells my office, the legislation does, that we should be guided by the principles of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which I suppose is why you're interviewing me today.
Yes. Before we dive into all the questions, Erwin, can you please define child and youth rights for us?
Well, most of the people listening will know that every person in the world has a set of rights under the Human Rights Code of the United Nations. Many people don't think of children as being rights holders in their own right. And I think if we remember that children are human beings themselves, and I know that sounds funny to say, but in many ways sometimes we forget that. We think of them as becoming human beings, but children themselves are human beings themselves and have a set of rights, same rights that any person in the world has, but there's a set of rights that children in their own right have. And that's why I mentioned the Convention on the Rights of the Child that every country in the world has signed, save the United States. And in Canada, there are a number of conventions of children's rights. Some in Ontario, for instance, under the Child and Family Service Act, children have a set of rights who are connected to the child welfare system or youth justice system. Under the Health Care Consent Act in Ontario, children are guaranteed a set of rights. So in other places besides the convention, children have particular rights to their circumstance afforded to them.
Thank you, Erwin. So you've mentioned children a lot when you're explaining child and youth rights. I find that as adults, we feel that children from age 11 and down, do not have like the capacity to express themselves or participate in decisions that impact their lives. How do you think we can work with children in elevating their voices up until the age of 11?
Well, yeah, it's pretty arbitrary, right? This concept of up to the age of 11, I think you're using that because in some of the legislation, Ontario 12 is a cutoff in terms of what a child is and when somebody becomes a youth. Other in programming ministries set that at 16, probably because around the age in which young people are permitted to work or expected to work starts around 16. But this idea of participation, so let me say this, in almost every set of rights that children have, from the UN Convention to the Child and Family Service Act to Health Rights Consent Act, almost every set of rights indicates that children have the right to participate in decisions that affect them. In Ontario, in most of the sets of rights, there is no marker that says, well, when does participation start? So, for instance, and most people in Ontario are surprised at this, children, no matter what age they are, have the right to participate in healthcare decisions made about them. It doesn't mean they have the right to decide, it means they have the right to participate. If they have the capacity, even around health rights, and I use that because for many it's the most stunning example, even if they have capacity, children around health decisions made about them have the right to consent. So, for instance, the child in the First Nations child who refused chemotherapy just a few months ago in Ontario set off a firestorm, but that child was exercising the rights afforded to her under the law, and that child was 11 years old. Many people thought, how can an 11-year-old make such an important decision? The point is that she would have to be deemed not having the capacity to make that decision. Some would argue that, well, she could make a decision about whether she should, have vitamins in the morning. A life and death decision like chemotherapy, a child does not, under a certain age, 12 or whatever, doesn't have the capacity to make. In the case of that child, the capacity decision was never tested. And I would argue it should have been. That certainly we should have decided whether she had the capacity to understand, and that's really what capacity is about. Does a child have the ability to understand the consequences of their action? Does a 12-year-old, does that 11-year-old understand what death means? Mm-hmm. That's a difficult question for any of us. Certainly the kind of question we're asking when we get into the right to die legislation that is happening federally. But children we have to consider in the same way that we consider adults about having capacity. Do they have the ability to understand that decision? If they do, I think more often than not we should help them make a proper decision. So yeah, children do have the ability to participate in everything. Let me say this that I want your listeners to remember, that even if that child was deemed incapable of making a decision that was life or death, like about the chemotherapy, even if she was deemed incapable, she still has the right to participate. So maybe an adult is going to make that final decision in her life, but they still have to weigh her wishes in making that decision. Now I get to that because any parent knows, and I'm a parent of an 11-year-old, that you can get into power struggles in the best of times with certainly my kids in my home, my 11-year-old and my 7-year-old, and it's always better if they feel listened to. If before I make a decision about where we're going on vacation or what we're doing on the weekend or if Granny is going to babysit or not or if we're moving homes, that I talk to them about the decision I have to make as an adult. I allow them to participate in that decision because it gets me into a buy-in situation instead of a power struggle situation with my own kids. If they feel listened to and feel heard, they're more likely they're going to be comfortable with the decision and more likely they're going to go along with it. That's a really important consideration when you talk about children and youth in my mandate of my office. Children and youth who are being taken care of by the state in children's mental health residences, in youth justice facilities, in children's aid, who often say they feel left out of their own lives. Decisions just happen willy-nilly around them and it seems chaotic. Does more trauma than what actually brought them into contact with the systems. So understanding what parenting might be in terms of not getting into power struggles, in terms of supporting young people to learn how to make decisions, to feel in control of their lives, is very transferable to the systems that try and serve children and youth, and certainly to young people, students, studying to be in the field as social workers or child and youth workers is very transferable. So it's important to understand that participation is not only a right, but really helpful in terms of the service we provide and helpful to building the capacity of children as they grow into adults.
And I would agree 100%. It sounds like in terms of like the right to participation, it's more of a partnership with, let's say, the adult and the young person.
Yeah, yeah.
And working together.
Yeah. Well, when we've done work as an office around health rights, even around what medication young people in group homes are given, young people have said that they don't see this right to decide on what health care they receive as a static decision that's made in one moment. They say that this right to consent to healthcare treatment is actually a dialogue that they want, a dialogue with somebody they trust, with a supportive adult that they trust, so that they can think through and talk through what the adult thinks is best for them, because they want to know, and what the options are, because they want to know, and what the person they trust thinks is best, and then they make the decision, and then they have feedback. And then they say that that decision doesn't happen in one moment, it happens over time, because people change too. They talk about that they might say they think one way today, and a month from now they might think differently. And again, they talk more about this ability to participate in terms of relationship, in terms of relationship with supportive people around them, supportive adults around them. And I think that's really important for service providers, parents, anyone to hear. That's not young people saying they want to decide and they're going to have it their way right now, and children saying that. They're saying, no, they want to participate, they want to engage in a dialogue, and they want to have supportive relationships with people around them and adults around them. They don't want to make these decisions alone.
So going off of that, with the relationship, how do you think that we as a whole society can make sure that child and youth rights are fully protected?
Yeah, I'm asked that a lot, and I'm thinking that about that a lot right now, more because of a situation with an adult in Hamilton. So there's an adult named Guy Mitchell who died. He was 38 years old, and there's an inquest about him. He died in a group home in Hamilton for developmentally delayed adults. He was significantly challenged. The inquest evidence says that he had the capacity of a five-year-old. He could speak and talk. He was a Special Olympian, the capacity of a five-year-old. He lived in this group home with another man and an 11-year-old child who was autistic. And he was found dead in the bottom of a well on the group home's property, and the group home parent was not around, hasn't been found. Apparently the police said the house was in such a disheveled state of repair, and no water, no heat. The toilets were overflowing with human waste. This is according to the police. And so the inquest is focusing on how this could have happened, how this group home could have existed, who had oversight. And there's a lot of thought about what recommendations the jury should make. And the reason I mention this in terms of your question is that where things are falling is that some people are saying there should be an institution like ourselves for adults who are vulnerable in government services, like government-run group homes. Government-funded group homes, where people can contact and somebody can either investigate or elevate the voice of these vulnerable adults. Very similar thought to why our office was created. And I think, yes, that's a really important thing. So institutions like ourselves can try and impose, protect, police, oversee children, or in this case, vulnerable adults, to receive the rights. But the other side of the coin, the other part of that argument is, no, people are saying, no, just creating an institution won't really make a difference on the ground for children to be afforded their rights. Children are rights bearers, as we've talked about, and then society is a duty bearer to make sure children do have their rights. The institution won't make things change on the ground. And I agree with that too. I think it's both. What the people who say institutional solution isn't the answer say that we have to create rights-based cultures in the services that we provide, in the homes that exist, in the culture of our province and of our country. We have to create a rights-based culture. And I think, and they don't go this far, but I think to do that, the first step to create a rights-based culture, the easiest step to create a rights-based culture, is to listen to children. Mm-hmm. Actually, the act of listening crates opens up both a place of safety for children and a place in which they can exercise the rights that they have. It's actually not rocket science. As young people tell me, it's not rocket science. All we have to do is start by listening, but really listening, not the kind of listening that, you know, my wife, when I talked about listening, says, you know, well, make sure you make it clear that it's not the kind of listening you do sometimes when I come home and tell you a story and I say to you, my wife says to me, you weren't listening to me. And I go, yeah, I was. And I repeat the very last sentence she said. She said, it's not that kind of listening. It's the kind of listening where you're engaged with your heart and your mind, concerned, thinking, trying to put yourself in the other person's place. That kind of active, empathetic listening that's built in relationship, that kind of listening will afford children and youth their rights. That's the most important thing to do, I think.
I think that's such an important point to make, with the type of listening that we as a society need to do with children and youth. And it's that type of active listening. You know, often, you know, when I was in school for child and youth care, they talked and taught us about active listening. And it sounds like you're talking about active listening, but on an even more deeper level, to fully take in what the young person is actually saying.
Yeah, to do that, the shift that is required to do that is to see those young people and children as people worth listening to. You know, in some cultures, I know you're going to ask me about that another point, but in some cultures, one of the biggest insults you can do to anybody is to ignore them. That's beyond calling them names or hitting them or doing anything else. Is just to ignore them, render them not a human being. And you do that by just acknowledging their existence. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to acknowledge children as human beings. We can do that by listening to them. It's a paradox, I guess, because we don't listen to them until we acknowledge them as human beings. And we have to acknowledge that they have something worth listening to. You know, I think about any of the people who listen, who've ever been in an argument with anybody, whether it's their spouse or their partner or their friends or their teachers or whoever. And if they remember back to those arguments and they were resolved, the point at which they were resolved wasn't in the solution, was in the listening. When they actually got to sit down, and they felt like they got to say what was wrong, and the other person actually listened and they thought understood them, you're halfway home. In fact, more than halfway home in finding a resolution to whatever the problem was. And your listeners will remember how that felt when they felt listened to, when they had that concern. How good that felt. How liberating that was. That's true for children. I mean, they're people. It's true for all of us. So that act of listening, I think, does that for all of us, and certainly does that for children. And we have to find a way to understand children as being worth that, just the way anyone in our society is.
So you brought up culture a little bit before, so I'm going to go down that road. Is it possible for child rights to coexist with cultural beliefs? So, for example, some cultures may view children at a certain age not to fully participate. So there may be some blurred lines. Do you think it's possible for that, for both to kind of coexist, and how would that kind of look?
Yeah, well, I certainly think that. So let me say a couple things. I mean, the culture that you're talking about, where children are not viewed as able to participate in and to be listened to, children should be seen but not heard. You know, that kind of philosophy. Yeah, I'd say that's the culture we have in Ontario. Is that the culture you're talking about? I don't think so, but I don't think we should think that we've got the culture that where children are fully liberated and seen as individuals and able to participate in decisions. So we're starting at a pretty low bar ourselves. Yeah. I think that, but I get what you're getting at. I think the important thing to realize is that there's a set of rights that children have under the Convention on the Rights of the Child that I think transcend culture. I remember a professor when I was in school teaching us around morality and where does morality come. He said, there isn't a culture in the world you can show me that thinks that sticking pins in babies' eyes is a good thing. And I thought, yeah, when you ask me about rights of children, I don't think there's a culture that doesn't say children should have the right to survive, which is one of the basic rights under the convention. It doesn't say that children, most cultures would agree that children have the right to have decisions made that are in their best interest. The right to participate, I think that when we think of participation in a liberal democratic way, which is where we're sitting, we're coming from, perhaps that can interfere with another way of thinking about the right to participate. But I think in the end, at its root, most people agree that it would be good for children to have some thought, some say, some knowledge about what happens to them. I think where I've been told and struggled with some of the challenge around rights, so I've said that rights, from my perspective, come from a liberal democratic kind of Western capitalist kind of approach, which builds on individualism. So rights, as we know them under these conventions and under our laws, afford individuals, including children, a set of rights. So individuals have a set of rights. Where that can come sometimes clash is where cultures exist, communities exist, for instance in First Nations communities, mm-hmm. where there's a sense of collective rights as well as individual rights. And sometimes people oppose individual rights against a collective rights. Let me give you an example. A child says they want to be adopted, and they want to be adopted in a culture or a community other than their own. Well, what if the community says, but we want our children, collectively, we want our children to stay within our community and stay within our culture? Who wins that argument? The right of the community to decide what happens to their children, or the individual child who might have a right to decide on what happens to them, but it runs counter to what the community and the collective wants. Mm-hmm. Who wins that? And how do you negotiate that? Are there competing rights in that case? And those are difficult. Those are very difficult challenges to negotiate. What I would say, and I'm no expert on this, but what I would say is when they've arisen, I think, again, the ability to listen, not just to the child, but to each other, to the community, to the leadership that might be speaking for the community, listen, is really important to find a resolution where both collective rights and individual rights can coexist. And I usually see that as being possible. It starts with listening again. It starts with willingness to be open, which really is part of a rights-based culture approach anyway.
So I have one more question to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
And this
is half an hour already.
Almost.
Sorry.
It's okay. this is kind of more of a personal question of a journey I'm trying to figure out, but what does advocacy mean to you?
In my act. It's a very unusual definition in the act for our office. Advocacy is defined as partnering with children and youth to bring their issues forward. So, for me, I guess, I've struggled with that. What does it mean? Certainly, advocacy is not about speaking for someone else, but it is about elevating voice. But I can't separate, and I cannot separate advocacy from making change,
mm-hmm.
from making a difference. And so for me, you know, I think elevating voice, making sure people are heard is really important. But for me, there has to be a point to it. And the point to that is to create change, is to push. And I usually I think of it as terms of pushing for equity mm-hmm. around something. So advocacy to me is using voice to create change. Some people think just speaking up is advocacy in itself. I'm not sure. I think it's about advocacy is about creating change and working for change.
I think that's a really good way for us to end our interview. Would you like anything else to say before we end our conversation?
Well, no, I don't. I'm just reiterate that I'm really glad you're doing this. I hope you have me on again, and I'll try and be more polished in my my answers. But I think it's a really important discussion, and I certainly look forward to listening to your podcast in the future. Thank you for doing it, Sammy.
Well, thank you for your time, Erwin.
You're welcome.
Your right to speak will be posted the second Wednesday of every month. If you are a child or a youth that would like to be on the show, or if you have a topic in mind that you think we should talk about, please email me at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Once again, Erwin, I want to say thank you, and let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast.
Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher.
Visit us online at cycpodcast.org.